Last week I asked you to keep some images in front of you, and those were images that we saw basically in chapters 4 and 5. The image of John entering through a simple door, but into the throne of heaven. The image of John seeing on that throne a lamb that seemed to have been slain. And the image of all the heavenly creatures and even the earthly creatures joining in the worship of those on the throne and the lamb who was on the throne. I want you to keep those images in view as we continue on with some new ones. But I want you to think also about an image that is only mentioned here, but I think it kind of permeates the whole thing. And that is simply what is mentioned in verse 17, this kind of paradox that the lamb is also the shepherd. And he is shepherding this great multitude as they are seen here in chapter 7 in heaven. In these two chapters, what happens is the lamb who is worshipped opens the scroll. And that's what we saw, and that was one of the images that we had in chapter 5 of the one on the throne holding a scroll. And now it gets opened. I have the suspicion, even if it's not mentioned here, that there's a great sense of anticipation as these seals begin to be opened. The scene, nonetheless, continues to be dominated by worship. And there's kind of an interesting thing that happens here in chapter 6 in particular, that it starts with the opening of the seals. It ends with the vision of what appears to be judgment. There are all these people who are running away from the God who is judging them, and they want to hide from him. It's almost as if this scene represents all of history. We'll talk about that a little bit as we get to the other visions of the seven trumpets and the seven bowls of wrath in the book of Revelation. But for now, just kind of think of it that way. The Lamb now is about to open the seals. The mysteries that this scroll represents are about to be made known. I always try to think of some way of getting you to envision the scene by perhaps setting you in a scene you're familiar with. I think you run the risk of maybe making it a little too mundane, and I kind of run that risk today, but I'm going to do it nonetheless because I think maybe it might help you see it. Think about when you're at a sporting event and you're anticipating the game about to begin, especially like a football game or a basketball game, because what they do is, you know, like in baseball, they all just kind of come onto the field at once. In football or in basketball, they say, okay, guys, here's your home team. And either they all run out at once or they start announcing them one at a time. And there's a great sense of, all right, guys, this is about ready to take place. Maybe they have some fireworks. Maybe there's a marching band or something. There's a great deal of things going on in anticipation for the team to come on the field. I kind of get that sense when they're all sitting around waiting for the seals to be opened. And when they're opened, there's kind of an announcer that says, come out. And the announcer is each of the four living creatures that we saw around the throne of God. For these four horses, these four first seals, these living creatures sort of serve as the announcer to come on out. And so it's done with a great deal of pomp and circumstance in a way, and with a great sense of anticipation. So think about that as you see what's going on here in the heavenly realms. Seal number one. The heavenly being calls for him to come out. And what comes out is a man, a rider on a white horse emerges from the seal. He carries a bow. He wears a crown. He is a conqueror. Seal number two. The second living creature says, come out. And a red horse gallops from the second seal. His rider wields a sword. And it says he basically takes peace from the earth and he causes people to kill one another. War and killing ensue. Seal number three. Come out, says one of the other voices. And a black horse emerges, riding, whose rider holds scales. And some mention is made of the prices that these scales are weighing, and they're kind of exorbitant prices. They're exorbitant because during a time of famine and war, things get overpriced. They are scarce. And it seems to fit with the other two, the conqueror and the one who is creating a war. Now things have become scarce. And then finally, seal number four. Seal number four sort of completes the first couple of seals. The progression from conqueror to warrior to famine and plague leads, fittingly enough, to a pale horse whose rider is death and who is followed by Hades, the abode of the dead. And so, the team has arrived. The four horses, who become known later on as the four horsemen of the apocalypse, conquering, killing, famine and plague, death. That's a pretty awe-inspiring group of horses. But we're not done with the seals yet. The fifth seal reveals those who have given their lives for the sake of the kingdom. Verse 8, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and whose name was Death, and Hades followed him, and they were given authority over a fourth of the earth. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw the altar, under the altar, the souls who had been slain for the word of God, and for the witness they had borne. So all of a sudden, we move from seeing the team on the field to those who have been affected by the war. They are the ones who have been martyred for their faith up to this point. And these martyrs are under the altar and they cry out for justice. Lord, are you not going to make this right at some point? And he says, basically, you guys be at peace. I'm taking care of this. I'm interjecting a little bit of what I think is actually going on there, of course. But, they're given a white robe and they're said, just bide your time. I got the seals, I'm in charge, everything's going to be okay. And so they are. And then he opens a sixth seal. And when the sixth seal is opened, things really begin to percolate. There's a great upheaval, it seems like, in heaven. The sky vanishes. The moon turns to blood. There's all kinds of cosmic upheavals going on. There's an earthquake. And the language that we get here is very similar to the language that the prophet Joel has used. And that in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus himself has used to describe the whole cosmos being affected and being changed. And there's this great upheaval. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, Jesus says, the sun will be made darkened and the moon will not give its light. And the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Jesus is applying that same kind of language to what is happening, what he describes to be happening during the time that the Jerusalem temple will be destroyed. Here it's being used, I believe, for a little different purpose, but still nonetheless to illustrate that a great cosmic upheaval is taking place. Energy. Things are happening. Things are percolating. And there seems to be an image of the end times because people are running scared. God is punishing them for their wickedness and they want to try to hide from him. Heaven is at war with earth. God, it seems, has launched his D-Day invasion. The four horsemen are ready, and they have started the end times happening. We see another vision here in chapter 7 is four angels. And these four angels are holding back the four winds of the earth. Okay? And another angel appears, and he comes out of the rising sun. There's all kinds of great images here about nature and about how these heavenly functionaries are operating, perhaps in the world today even. And this fifth angel prevents the four angels from harming the saints. And it's almost like in the interim time after God has launched his D-Day invasion, it's like he's saying to the church, okay, guys, but you're going to be okay here. You're going to have to live through all of these times, but you know what? I'm protecting you. And that's the vision we get in chapter 7, is the 144,000 and the great multitude, etc., etc. And I think this is where we begin to get even some more questions about the book of Revelation. Who are these people? What is that all about? Why the numbers? And so I have kind of a list of a series of questions as we look at chapter 7 that have often been raised over the centuries and certainly perhaps are on our minds. First of all, after the seal is given to protect the saints, we see that 144,000 are being protected out of the tribes of Israel. Well, who are these 144,000? There are some groups over the years who have taken that to be a literal number, and that only 144,000 people of all the tribes of the earth are going to be saved. I do not think that is a correct interpretation of this. I'm not even sure the number is absolutely literal. But I think maybe if we take the number 12, which is generally considered a complete number, certainly has to do with the 12 tribes of Israel, and multiply it by 12,000, we get 144,000, you get perfection times perfection. The right number of people will come in at the right time. That's probably what he's trying to say. It represents complete completeness, if you want to think of it that way. The full number of the people of Israel have been sealed and protected. Is he talking about literal Israel? Perhaps. Is he talking about the perfect number of the complete number of Israel and the Gentiles? Maybe. I'm not really sure I can tell you which one of those it is. What I can tell you is they're safe. He's protecting them. And he's protecting them until such a time that everybody comes in. And it's interesting because we get another picture of not just these 144,000 of the tribe of Israel, which would be a great connection. Remember, John has done this several times. He's made a connection all the way back to the Old Testament numerous times in his images here, not the least of which are the images of the throne room of God, which go all the way back to Ezekiel and Isaiah and some other places. So he's done the same thing here by drawing our attention to what God has done in the past among the Israelites. But then we see this picture of a great multitude. I mean, a great multitude. And he says they are without number. I wonder if that doesn't bring to mind sort of the reminiscent of the picture Abraham was given about how many of his descendants there were going to be. Remember what Abraham was told to look at? First of all, he says, look at the stars of the sky. Can you number those? And as we have developed bigger and bigger telescopes, we have begun to see that not only are there millions of stars, but there are millions of galaxies with millions of stars within them. And so you really, the number just seems to go on and on and on and on. Or Abraham is told it's like numbering the sand on the seashore. Now, you know, just take the Jersey Shore, which is pretty big, all right? Not to mention all the shores of the entire world where there is sand available. But just take the Jersey Shore and try to number the sand, the grains of sand on the Jersey Shore. You got quite a task ahead of you. Even though a lot of it's been washed away, they keep replacing it. There's a lot of sand. All that doesn't even matter. The idea is there's so many of them, you can't number them. That's the great multitude that he sees here. So were we to say, are there just 144,000 saved? Well, what do we do with the great multitude who are there as well? That's why I think maybe 144,000 is probably not a literal number, but it means perfection. Here is the great multitude who are in the heavenly places, and they have come from all over the earth, from every tribe and nation and language, etc., etc., etc. They hold palm branches in their hands. They are clothed in white. And they praise the Lamb for his salvation. We are told that these are people who come out of the great tribulation and they have been washed and made white by the blood of the Lamb. That doesn't sound to me like he's referring to a specific group of people only. Anybody who has been washed by the blood of the Lamb gets to be a part of the great multitude. And again, it transcends time, it transcends place, it transcends nations. It allows there to be the possibility that they indeed could be more than the sands of the sea and more than the stars in heaven. It's a great multitude. But another issue is raised here, another question perhaps, another great thing. And that is the great tribulation. What is that? Some have specified over the years and interpreted this to be a very specific time period. It's possible. It's possible. He's referring to something very specific in history. Mark chapter 13 verse 19 uses the same idea and indicates it is a time of destruction around the period that Jerusalem was destroyed. So he speaks of that as a great tribulation. In fact, it says it's going to be worse than anything has ever happened in history up to that point. But I rather suspect that he may have some other things in mind. It may be an allusion to maybe more things, because since then, the church has been through numerous persecutions, times of hostility, and periods of heresy that have racked the church with this great tribulation, these great problems, both physical, emotional, doctrinal, whatever they might be. And you see, as individuals, Christians are called, are they not, to suffer with Christ? Romans chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. We are told in Revelation 2 and verse 26 that they are told they have to endure to the end. And so there's going to be a period of time when everybody's going to have to endure. There won't be this one single time and then it won't ever happen again. I'm just not convinced that that's maybe the reference here. I tend to look at this as a little bit bigger than just one time. Would be willing to admit that I could be wrong about that. And maybe there's still some great persecution about to take place or greater tribulation than has ever happened still about to take place. I would not leave that possibility out. And it is quite within the realm of God's scheme of things that could be what's going to happen. But again, I rather suspect that it may be simply the entire end times in which we have lived since the coming of Christ. Great persecutions come, great persecutions, great tribulations kind of come and go. And we have to endure them. And maybe our discussion this morning of the book of Ecclesiastes, we're all going to endure some of those kinds of things at some point in our lives. The fact is, this group has conquered. They've come out of that great tribulation. And they are now in the same place that we see in chapters 4 and 5, where all the heavenly beings are engaging in worship. And it's just fascinating to me that the more I look at the book of Revelation, the greatest picture that I see of what the church is doing, what the people of God are doing, what all the heavenly beings are doing, is worshiping God. That's the sort of basic mode of operation for what's all going on in heaven. And we are, the people of God, are learning to participate in that worship of God. Both when we come together and when our lives take a sort of different tack during the week, are we not still supposed to be engaged in somehow our lives are living worship to God? That's what the universe does. It worships God because God was indeed its creator. And so when we see chapter 7 and verse 17, the lamb becomes the shepherd, we have a sort of great paradox here, and perhaps it's part of the reason why we read Psalm 23, we think about Jesus being our good shepherd. That's the picture that we have here. In the midst of that great multitude, there is the lamb, and he's doing the shepherding. A kind of odd picture. But you see here, heaven is at worship. Again. In chapter 1 and verse 10 of the book of Revelation, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. John starts the very book at worship on the Lord's day. In chapters 4 and 5, we saw this great picture of all the heavenly beings giving praise to God and honor and glory and so forth. And some of the great songs and some of the great language of worship that we have comes from Revelation chapters 4 and 5. And then, of course, here we have the multitudes. And to cap it all off, in Revelation 22 and verse 9, when John encounters another heavenly being and he falls down before them, he says, No. Don't worship me. He says, worship God. It's almost a fitting end to what the whole book has been all about. Well, I'm exaggerating a little bit for the sake of effect. It's not just about worship, but it's about the whole narrative of God conquering evil. But everybody's worshiping God in the midst of it. Heaven and earth come together to blend their voices in worship. And you see, it's in worship that we really kind of see the invisible heavens. We begin to get a picture of just what the universe is really all about. We participate with all of the voices in heaven and raise our voices to this God who preserves and protects and who brings about the opening of the seals and the mysteries revealed to us about what's going on. All of the activities that we have, all of our very lives and our very selves really grow from our willingness and ability to join with those voices in worship. It is indeed our worship that humbles us, feeds us, and connects us. Gives us the strength to do all the things that God has called us to do. But it's got to start with worship. It's got to start with us, I think, literally and figuratively prostrating ourselves before God, who is indeed the one worthy of all power and glory and honor. We conclude, we would be remiss if we didn't conclude, with the seventh seal. And in the midst of all this vision of the horses and all this other rumblings and thunders and lightnings and so forth, suddenly we have the seventh seal open, and what happens? You have silence. For about a half hour, which is kind of an odd thing to begin with in heaven. Does time really pass? You know, but John seems to reckon some sense about a half an hour of silence takes place. Just silence. Yeah, how uncomfortable do we get when things are quiet? You know, we sort of can't handle the vacuum. You know, we have to have something happening. Have to have, you know, something stimulating us in one way or another. I wonder if we have learned to heed the voice of Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 20. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. I don't know if that is a way of encouraging us to, you know, a little bit more of a life of contemplation. I rather think it's not such a bad thing. It may be functioning in some other way. I wonder if it maybe isn't just sort of a prelude to the battle that's about to take place. Troops are all assembled over here. God's in his holy temple. And everything's quiet. The suspense just builds as he continues on with what comes next, and that is these seven trumpets. Ultimately, fire again comes from the altar, and it creates rumblings, lightning, and an earthquake once the silence is over. So suddenly you have this interlude, and everything begins again. God shakes the earth. We're told in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 26 and 27, that God had shook the earth in order to bring about an unshakable kingdom. So what we see here is a picture of God doing what he said he's going to do, and the anticipation is something unshakable is going to come out of this. That's what the narrative is all about. That's what all the visions are trying to get us to see. And so we should think about for ourselves and encourage one another, as I seek to encourage us today, to live for a time when our songs will literally, although I think they do now, but will literally blend with all the heavenly beings in worship. And everything has finally come to a conclusion. In the meantime, you must learn to endure and to conquer so that each of you might also participate with that great multitude.